Callahan.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the Dead Farmer's Almanac, a novel that suggests the government can control Minnesota's weather. Available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com.
It's 6 minutes now past 11 o'clock. And good morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Acton. Glad you could join us this morning. If you were a reporter, it was one of those too-good-to-be-true stories. Two of Minnesota's most influential and most popular public figures going toe-to-toe over an issue of major importance to the state of Minnesota. Governor Jesse Ventura versus University of Minnesota President Mark Udall. State funding for the University of Minnesota at stake. The future of higher education. Size of the headlines kept getting bigger and bigger until one day it all came to a head. We found ourselves speculating whether they would publicly shake hands or not. Well, they did, and the story of Ventura versus Udall has largely died down from those heady days of January and February. But the issue of higher education funding certainly has not gone away. In fact, it's almost decision time at the state capitol. A legislative conference committee will soon begin working out the differences between the Minnesota House and Minnesota Senate versions of a higher education bill, one that funds both the U and the Minnesota State College and University system. Both houses of the legislature have already voted to give the U more money than the governor proposed, but neither chamber has proposed spending as much as the university has requested. And joining us today to discuss what that might mean for the University of Minnesota and also to take your questions is University of Minnesota President Mark Udall. If you have a question or comment for President Udall, we invite you to give us a call here, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828. President Udall, thanks for coming in today.
My pleasure to be here.
First of all, I have to ask you, in retrospect, any regrets that the debate over university funding, at least initially, got cast as a kind of heavyweight boxing match?
Well, I do have some regrets about that, although I don't think I cast it that way. It was just too tempting to have put the picture of two bald guys on the front page of the newspapers. I think the governor's made an effort really not to personalize it, and I've made an effort not to personalize it, and I sure don't want to arm wrestle with him. Maybe checkers, at best checkers.
Has the process, for the most part, worked as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think it's not worked as well as we'd like, and we can talk about the reasons, but I think it's it tells you something about how unreasonable the original proposal was, that number that has been voted on by the House of Representatives is 50% higher than the governor recommended, and the number in the Senate is 2 to 3 times higher. I mean, I don't think it was intended this way. I don't think the governor had it in for the university. I think he had a vision of state government. But the consequences of this really would have been disastrous for the university. And it's very rare that you see a legislative body, one controlled by one party and one by the other, have such add-ons to the governor's initial recommendation. Now, maybe the governor felt that would happen anyhow, and he was lowballing it to sort of come out with a budget overall that he could live with. I can't speculate about that, but you can find virtually no one in the legislature who says, you know, that $56 million would do it when it's $2 million than our increase, $2 million less than our increase in health premium insurance, which we, up to now at least, we are unable to control because it's a state plan. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of range, long way to improve what was recommended, but the political process has produced a dramatically different result than the one that the governor recommended.
Assuming for a moment that the House and Senate end up more or less splitting the differences and then they give you a little additional money for the Academic Health Center, let's say $100 million in additional funding. You wanted $221 million. Where does that leave the university?
Well, I want to say one thing. I think what the Senate did is responsible. I think it's midway between what the governor recommended and what I asked for. I think we should all rally. I'm talking to our alumni and so forth behind the Senate proposal. It's 2/3 of a cake instead of a third. If we were to get a number like the House's, and maybe slightly higher because it's a compromise with the Senate, What you would get is basically a loss of momentum and a standstill budget. We would pay our inflationary costs. We'd give 3% salary increases, and we would pay our health premium bills. We would make sure our buildings are heated, pay the extra natural gas cost, and that they're maintained. But we would basically do nothing else. That is, there wouldn't be one more pharmacist produced. There wouldn't be one more dentist produced. There wouldn't be any improvement in undergraduate education. And there would be probably a double-digit increase in tuition to put the whole package together. So it's obviously not the end of the university. And I'm not saying that the governor recommended a cut. What I am saying is that when you have $1,500 in new inflationary cost in your family for paying for high-cost gasoline and all the rest, and you get a $1,000 raise, the $1,000 is new money. It's not a cut, but you're still $500 short of being where you were the previous year in terms of your grocery bills, your rent, your gasoline, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And under even the best of circumstances, still looks like some hefty tuition increases at the U.
Well, I think if we could adopt the Senate bill, we could probably keep tuition under two digits, and which is good for our students in terms of access. In addition to covering the inflationary cost, I think we could add some professors, like in computer science, where we really need more students to graduate as computer science majors. I think we probably would proceed to with our cooperative relationship with Winona State and Mayo to produce more nurses for the state of Minnesota. I think we could do some things that need doing. We probably, at least for our stars on the faculty, we could have somewhat more substantial raises, because they're the people that we're constantly in danger of losing. I think we could do some but not all the things that we wanted to do. We will not come out of this in the Senate bill solving our health care crisis. We will still be short pharmacists. We will still be short dentists. We will still be short medical technicians. And we will not be positioning ourselves versus the National Institutes of Health to bring in all that research money, because we will not be adding many medical school professors. So the needs were genuine. And what I like about our budget is there really wasn't any puffing. What you pay for is what you get. We asked for 15 new professors of computer science. We can allocate 0 or 15 or any number in between, depending upon the level of the appropriation. But one thing I know, we can't deliver the same level of services that we would have been able to deliver had we received full funding.
Now, both the House and the Senate have provisions in their bills which would essentially take a look at the program offerings at the U in one fashion or another, and try to come up with a list of priorities that you folks should be emphasizing, and, as I understand it, a list of things that perhaps you might want to get rid of. Are you happy with that approach?
Well, let me say, I am very happy with accountability. I believe in it. I think the people of Minnesota deserve it, and we have cooperated on all the accountability measures in the House and Senate. You want to see what sort of bang for the buck you're getting, what the graduation rate is. You want to figure out how much it costs to produce a credit hour, how much research the faculty is bringing in. Any measure that they have, I feel we can meet it, at least in the sense that we're improving. We may not be where we all want to be. So I'm very comfortable, and my understanding is I think the governor's maybe underlying purpose was to secure more accountability. And I'm hoping in the next few weeks we'll probably get together. I assume we will, and I'd like to talk to the governor about accountability, maybe to give him assurances that if the number is higher than what he recommended, that the money will be well spent. With respect to the multiplicity of offerings, it's an unusual problem. We actually have focused, and I mean dramatically so. We have put large investments in biological sciences, genomic research. We put it in computer science, digital technologies, agriculture, the areas that makes sense. We have actually focused a great deal, moved around $80 million from lower priorities to this, cut $33 million out of the central budget. But we are very diverse. And my theory of this is, and I'm sure we can do better, is it reflects the diversity of our state. That people who think that we spend too much money in agriculture have to talk to the members of the legislature who believe passionately in our agricultural research and our outreach programs and the like. Others who may be wary about some of our other activities, then they have to talk to the people who want us to promote literacy programs and so forth. A lot of the diversity of the school reflects the fact that Minnesota's diverse and that we only have one university. It's easy to have Michigan charge high tuition and have a narrow range of program when there's Michigan State down the block picking up all the other programs. We have to offer what Michigan State and Michigan offer and do it at a reasonable price, and that's not easy. Having said all that, if the legislature or others think we're in the wrong area, I'm ready to receive the message, but I think most of our programs have very substantial Minnesota constituencies behind them. And even with that, we have been pretty effective in moving around money, not front page news. The best way to do this is not to be in the newspapers at all, but to quietly move resources around, and basically that's what we've done.
Our guest this hour, University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff, who has come by today to bring us up to date on where he sees these last days of the legislative session going, vigorous debate this year over higher education funding is turning out. Also, to take your questions, if you have a question for President Udoff, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number would be 1-800-242-2828. Faculty salaries. We heard a lot about that these last few months. Given the amounts of money that are now being talked about at the Capitol, House proposal, Senate proposal, and so on, is there enough money in there? You expressed concern these last several months about the need to keep university faculty salaries competitive. Is there enough money for that?
I really don't think so. None of the proposals, I think, would enable us to do the multi-year increases designed to sort of put us in the middle of the pack of the major national research universities. And, you know, again, I think in part it depends on what the people of Minnesota want. If you look just at the Midwest, as one newspaper did, we do pretty well. And we're midway in the pack. And if you want us to just try to recruit professors that get offers from Indiana or from Illinois or Iowa and so forth, that's fine. But if you really want us to compete nationally and secure the services of a plant geneticist who might have gone to Cornell, then it's not fine. You have to be competitive nationally and not just regionally. So that's one issue. Another issue is we don't distribute salary monies equally. We just don't do it. We try to give people a cost of living, but one professor may get 1% and another may get 10%. It's based both upon merit and competitiveness. And one thing the listener should understand, and maybe it just doesn't rub them right, it is a little bit like athletics. If you have a molecular biologist who's very good, there is a national competitive market. And if you pay $10,000 less, you're just not going to keep someone, or you're not going to be able to get their services in the first place. We may wish the world were different, but that is the world that we live in. And those competitive pressures are real. So it's not just a question of fairness, and it's not just a question of are we being taken to the cleaners because Joe Jones will make more money than somebody else. The question is, do you want to be competitive or not? And you can't run these programs without the faculty. How the heck would we ever have programs to look into Parkinson's disease and look into diabetes and look into cancer and connect and have genetic programs without the personnel to do them? We can build all the buildings we want and nothing will happen. So there has to be a commitment to recruit and retain the people who will actually do that research, and they are highly sought after.
Is there any, it's kind of a side issue, but struck me, you used the analogy with athletics. Is there any upper limit that you would, at some point, where the university would say, you know, you're a heck of a molecular biologist, but we're just not going to pay that much for
you to be?
Happens
all the time. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, we're a public university, and at some point you're turning out the lights to recruit someone, and it's bad for morale. And you're right. I mean, at some point. It happens with sports teams. You just say, well, that's just too rich a package for this institution. Actually, Gary, you know, it more frequently happens. It happens on salary, but the really big bucks are in the laboratory space and the number of amount of equipment and the number of technicians to run the equipment. I think I mentioned last time I was on, we had one professor who was offered an $8 million package at the university of Chicago. And she might have gotten a big raise, but it was a small portion of the $8 million because that went for equipment, it went for laboratory space, it went for assistant professors to help her, it went for researchers, for stipends for graduate students. People have to understand that research in the sciences is less and less of a cottage industry. I mean, it really involves many people in big teams with from many disciplines, and it's expensive, and it's no accident. There are only 60 research universities in America that are really big into research, and I suspect that number will go down year by year in the next 25 years. And the question, I think, for Minnesotans to decide is, do you want us on the list or not? And I think the biggest reason for being on the list is that you attract good people who come to the state and stay. And because we can license the technology in Minnesota, give them first crack at it. There are various advantages to being the place where an AIDS drug is developed, even though it's perfectly true if it were developed in Great Britain, it might be equally available to Minnesotans as if it were developed on our West Bank campus.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a full bank of callers here with questions for President Mark Udall, so let's get started. Chris, you're first. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to say to President Udall, I think you're doing a great job. I want to say I just keep up the good work. I'm looking at a Star Tribune poll published in April 18th that showed more support among college graduates and self-described Democrats for Ventura's proposal and less support for more funding. Do you have a theory as to why that is? I think the people who don't support public education in this state are being penny wise and pound foolish, and I don't think they care about the future of this state. Incidentally, I attended the university many years ago and would like to finish my degree, but can't afford it because of the quantum leaps in tuition.
Okay.
I support the U, and I have let my state legislators know.
Chris, thank you very much. And by the way, I hope you'll call our financial aid office. Let's try to work something out that you can come back to the university and complete your degree. And, well, you know, there were two polls. There was a Pioneer poll earlier, which suggested that people did care about investing in higher education and faculty salaries and the like. And then there was the Star Tribune poll. And I don't mean to be the I'm a lawyer, you know, Philadelphia lawyer, so you may not want to take all this at face value. But I think the question in the Star Tribune, which said, you know, would you rather spend $1 zillion to give them their priorities or would you rather get it back, they got the answer that was predictable. When you ask the question, do you think we ought to have a reasonable access to a first-class university, you get another answer. That's my own view. I may be wrong, and it may be I'm just defensive about it. I think the problem is in part demographic. When I looked at that poll, you might have noticed they had a rank order of different services. And more people seemed interested in health care and the price of pharmaceutical drugs, and they seemed more interested in crime and prevention of crime. And when you look at it, those the things that affect everyone has a health problem, or at least they want to stay healthy. As you go down the list, and the bottom of the list was welfare, and then K through 12 and higher education were somewhere in the middle. I think you're right. There is a sort of problem with a loss of status of a public good, a recognition of the sort of larger purposes of government, and the fact that when someone graduates K through 12 or from a university, it's not just for that person. It's for the whole state in terms of the benefits that that brings. And it bothers me a lot. I mean, I think health care is important. I think low-price drugs are important for our senior citizens. But the way I read that list is if it doesn't directly impact your family, then you're less likely to see it as a priority. And I think we have to work harder. There is a concept of the public good, that things that benefit all of us. They may be bridges. They may be airports. They may be lots of things. But I think when we turn out a computer science graduate from the University of Minnesota, it does good things for Minnesota as well as doing good things for Mary Smith or John Jones and their families.
Might those polls also reflect a kind of latent suspicion, though, President Udall, that there are vast amounts of money being wasted at the U of M? I know when we do these call-in programs, and not necessarily when you're here, but other people that we get into these discussions, and well, you get a lot of calls from people. Well, I work at the university, or I used to work at the university, and boy, the money, boy, Governor Ventura, you're right on. It's just being wasted.
That's wrong. You know, we made an accountability presentation and showed the $33 million we had cut centrally, the $80 million in reprioritization. I would compare our record to any of the commissioners and the departments. How many of them have not only gotten rid of three associate commissioners, vice presidents in our case, but their whole offices and so forth? And I do think there should be some suspicion. We're not as efficient as we ought to be. I agree with that. But what I would say is this, and we need to be accountability, we need efficiency, we need to be held up to a line, but many times these arguments are make weight for those priorities. In healthcare, we have inefficiencies of a grand scale. In pharmaceuticals, it's important to get needed drugs down to the right price, but there can be overconsumption of drugs, which is not good for people's health. In the criminal law system, we try to do our very best, but it really is hard to change people when they're in prison and turn them out as good citizens. Every one of them has issues of efficiency. Every one has issues of accountability. And all of them are inefficient by degree. So I'm not arguing that. But I think when you see the vehemence with which they look at sometimes at K-12 or higher education, it is explained as much by the relative priorities of the speaker as it is by the university spends its money less well than the XYZ department or the healthcare system.
Scott, your question, please.
Yes, good morning, Gary. I had a question, and it really speaks to the benefit that you were talking about just a minute ago to Minnesota. When I think about the money, the bottom line to me is that we're not charging tuition at a level that covers the cost, and so the state needs to subsidize that. And so I'm wondering, how does it benefit me as a Minnesotan to pay for a new computer scientist education for him to either have a high-paying job in Minnesota or move to some other state and have a high-paying job? How does that benefit me as a taxpayer? And the other part of the subsidy seems to be the research part of it. I'm completely for research, and I think there's some very valuable areas there. But, you know, from what I hear in the media, it seems like most of the research dollars end up going to benefit private industry. They end up either in spinoffs or they end up benefiting someone in private industry that will then turn around and charge me for that product that is the results of that research. Okay. So it might seem somewhat selfish, but I really don't see the direct correlation and the benefit to people in Minnesota to pay these tax dollars out.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
Scott, you raised really some profound questions, and I think I disagree with you at least in part, and I'll try to answer as best I can. That person who gets the degree may start a business and employ other Minnesotans. That person may come up with a computer software package that benefits people in Minnesota and elsewhere. That person will pay taxes that will help with public service projects and so forth to help develop the Minnesota economy. That person may be more likely to vote and participate in democratic processes. So I think at a variety of levels, education is a public good. It does not just benefit the immediate recipient, although it does benefit the immediate recipient. The research thing, I think you have to understand how it works, and we may disagree about that. First of all, they're not your dollars going into research. There's almost zero from the state of Minnesota. We get $455 million a year in research, which is almost dollar for dollar what you pay for the support of the university. We get about $580 million a year, which is one-third of our total cost, and we get $455 million in research, almost dollar for dollar. You put in a dollar, the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, the Department of Agriculture. So one question is, do you want the money going to Wisconsin, Iowa, Idaho, and Arizona? Or do you want to see that money come into Minnesota, creating jobs with each dollar that's spent? Second, I admit I'm a capitalist, but let's take an AIDS drug, which has been controversial recently. We get money from the NIH to support research. To test an AIDS drug is hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. Without an economic system that allows a company to make a profit on that, the drug probably will never come into being. Because remember, only one drug out of dozens or hundreds may actually prove itself to be efficacious and with side effects that are reasonable. So I don't think it's any accident that the great breakthroughs in science and mathematics and medicinal chemistry and so forth have tended to come from those countries that have strong intellectual property systems. Because, you know, and this is a big problem. One of the problems we have in alternative and complementary approaches, and I think they're fine, and we ought to test them, is that if it's there's no way to protect one's property interest in it, then no one has an interest in testing its efficacy. That's the problem. So having to pay for it, I think people would prefer to have a cure for AIDS that they pay for than not have one. I also think the government may want to subsidize it. The drug companies may want to give it away for free in certain cases. I'm in favor of all that. But that research, I think, is the envy of the world. Your standard of living and the transistors, the computers, much of what you take advantage of in your life today came out of public and large private universities in America since World War II. That's just the truth of it.
Our guest this hour, University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff. If you have a question for President Udoff, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to more of your calls here in a couple of minutes.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. Peter Ungen conducts works by Peter Schickley, featuring pianist Jean-Yves Thibaudet at the Ordway, May 4th and 5th. Tickets at www.thespco.org.
We once got this review, and it said they can't act, they can't sing, they can't dance, they can't play their instruments. And for us, you know, we agreed with that.
The bitter truth. Plus all the day's news on All Things Considered, weekdays at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
Members of the Coleman Berry Legacy Circle have included MPR in their estate planning, and we're grateful for their generous support. For more information, call 800-227-2811 and ask for Pat Cook. Right now, some news headlines. Here's Kathleen Hallinan. Kathleen?
Thank you, Gary. The Pentagon says Chinese officials aren't being very helpful to the U.S. civilian team inspecting a Navy spy plane. The Chinese today thwarted a plan to power up the plane on Hainan Island by failing to provide the technical support requested by the Americans. They wanted to check electronics and hydraulics. A top Israeli envoy says President Bush and the Jewish state have similar views on the peace process. Foreign Minister Shimon Peres says Bush is keen on restarting talks but won't impose on the parties. Peres met with the president in the Oval Office, then told reporters he found Bush totally devoted to the peace process. Florida prosecutors continue to build their case that Nathaniel Brazel intentionally shot and killed his teacher. A friend testified today that the boy asked him for a gun the day of the shooting and said he planned to go to the school to cause trouble. Today's sell-off on Wall Street follows a four-day advance for the NASDAQ Composite Index. It was up 9% in 4 days, so analysts say today's declines were expected. The pullback comes amid some news that more people headed to the unemployment office for the first time last week, further suggesting that weakness remains in the economy. In regional news, rowdy fans nearly caused the Twins to forfeit last night's game. The New York Yankees left the field twice because Twins fans were throwing bottles, coins, and hot dogs at former Twin Chuck Knoblauch. More than 40 people were ejected from the Metrodome. The Twins won 4-2. Governor Ventura and Twins owner Carl Pohlad met privately yesterday. Ventura's spokesman says Pohlad requested a meeting, apparently to discuss state funding for a new Twins stadium. Far southeastern Minnesota is under a flash flood watch. It goes into effect this afternoon, lasts until tonight. It will be partly to mostly cloudy statewide today with rain and thunderstorms likely in the south. There's a chance of rain in central Minnesota, and we're looking for highs in the 60s. Gary, that's the news.
All right. Thank you, Kathleen. It's 25 minutes before 12. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio, and our guest this hour is University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff. Lots of callers on the line with questions for President Udoff. Joe, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Just two quick questions. First one was, what is Mr. Udoff's position with the Vikings approaching the state legislature to have a dual-use stadium to be built on the university grounds? And second, what is the president's position in terms of some of the salaries paid to coaches like Coach Monson, who I believe makes around $500,000 a year? That's all I have.
Well, Joe, you ask tough questions. You can't take the Fifth Amendment on this show, I assume. And on the Vikings stadium, My feeling, the feeling of our faculty, our Board of Regents, is that we have too many pressing academic issues. If you want to put $200 million into something, I would suggest the medical school will save more human lives, will have better clinical services, will do research that's first rate. And the only reason we really even discussed it, had a presentation, is if in the wisdom of our betters in the legislature or the business community, a stadium is built and they're intent upon having the Vikings and the Gophers play in the same facility, then we have an interest in what it looks like, where it is, how compatible it is with the site type of college football that we play. So we wanted to get our oar in the water, get our 2 cents in. But given the magnitude of the needs of the state, 600,000 workers short in the next decade, the crisis in health care, the need to improve undergraduate education alike, I do not favor taking public money and putting it in. I favor putting it into the University of Minnesota and maybe some other educational institutions. I don't like the salaries we pay coaches. But then again, I don't like the salaries we pay baseball players, and I don't particularly like the salaries we pay movie stars. And it's a little like when I talked earlier about molecular biologists or plant geneticists or electrical engineers. If you want to be in this business, you have to be competitive, and the market sets it. Coach Munson is a wonderful coach, in my view, very balanced in terms of his acumen on the court and his support of academic programs. And good coaches cost a lot of money, and as you know, Coach Mason is paid even more. I might add they all make more than I make, which is probably fortunate. So I just think, Joe, the answer to this is that you don't do things halfway. If you want a Division I athletic program, it should be among the best, and you do what you need to do within the rules, with integrity, consistent with the academic program, to field competitive men's and women's teams.
Another Joe is on the line from Minneapolis. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. This is Joe from Minneapolis. Yes, I've heard a rumor by supporters of Governor Ventura's budget program that there's $1 billion in an endowment fund at the University of Minnesota, and it can be spent on anything, buildings, whatever, and that the university refuses to use this money. They want to keep that. Is this true?
No. There's a little bit of confusion. Let me explain it. We have a campaign over 7 years to raise $1.3 billion. We've raised over $1 billion. But the nature of an endowment is that you're not allowed to spend the corpus, i.e. it's like a bank account where you can't spend the balance. You have to live off the interest. So when we raised the total $1 billion, which, by the way, includes our one-third share of debt service on some of our buildings, and which includes some equipment and includes a lot of other things, at best it will produce $60 million a year in income. You're not allowed to spend your endowment. And so you're talking about $60 million compared to a $1.8 billion a year budget. I have to tell you, Joe, if I'd spent it, I would go to jail. I mean, people contribute endowments. They say, here's $100,000. I want to support a scholarship. It's an endowment. It means year after year, you allocate $5,000 or $6,000 to a student scholarship. You never touch the balance in the account. And that's what an endowment is. And this idea that there's a spaghetti fund. And by the way, it's all restricted. Virtually 98% of it is restricted. It can only be spent for scholarships, or it can only be spent on a building, or it can only be spent on a certain type of professor who teaches Portuguese history or something like that. It really is untrue. I mean, to me, this is a sort of a conspiracy theory that the university has these buckets of money that they're secreting away and that we could just reach in. Same thing's, by the way, true of the research. You know, if I take the Pentagon money for laser beam research and I put it into the English department to teach Shakespeare, I go to jail. I mean, that is, it is for specific purposes, and it is only the income from it which can be spent, and not the endowment. And people will stop giving if the state stops its support. People don't like funding the basics. They want to add a few $1,000s to professor's salary to enable you to recruit a good professor. If you don't have the base money to bring the professor in, they're just not going to do it. No one wants to fund Xerox machines and cutting the grass. People want to fund high-level research and things like that.
I was going to say that would be the other question. If you can raise over $1 billion for the endowment, why can't you raise, $500 million just for operating expenses?
There's no university in America that does that. because it's impossible. And this is public education, a public good. I don't think we ought to pass around the hat to do it, but it is impossible to raise sums of money even remotely like that year after year to allow you to plan for it. And it's not done at Michigan, which is perhaps our most affluent in terms of endowment. They charge a very high tuition. It's not done in California, which has reasonable tuition, but high level of subsidization. It doesn't work.
Kevin, your question, please.
Yeah, hi, Yudof. I think you're doing a good job. But I have a question. Student Senate last year requested removal of the foreign language requirement, which seems to be unfair to older students and rough on everyone. And about 80%, according to a survey, wanted it removed. And to my knowledge, only the name requirement had changed. I'll take my answer off the air. I got a few other questions, but I won't.
Okay, well, we're going to get to some other callers.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin.
Well, Kevin, I don't know what to say. The my general position as president is I don't tell the College of Liberal Arts what the appropriate curriculum requirements are. And you're perfectly right that there are many students who have objected to this mastery of a foreign language. And there are also a lot of educators, a lot of parents, a lot of students who think acquisition of a second language in a global economy and so forth is very important. So all I can say is that the way Kevin perceives it is not the way the College of Liberal Arts faculty and dean thus far at least have seen it. And I don't view myself as jumping in with 2 feet. And I say that, Kevin, with a lot of respect because my lowest grades in college were all in Spanish. And my neurons just did not snap when I was taking Spanish, and it was the toughest course. And you're probably right. As you get older, language acquisition becomes harder and harder. That's what the neuroscience shows us. So I sympathize, but this is a curricular matter for the faculty.
University President Mark Yudof is our guest. If you have a question for the president, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We were talking earlier about what looks like legislative interest in the U trying to identify its priority programs, maybe phase out some that aren't such high priority. Have you, in terms of a broader higher education system question here in Minnesota, have you and the Minsky system come to agreement on what it is that each of you are supposed to be doing?
Oh, I think we're in really good shape on that. We signed an agreement with the Minnesota State College and University System in 1998, and I think, I don't remember the exact number, we have 150 or more cooperative programs with that system. And they range from what are called these articulation agreements, which means that when you enroll in a community college and you take certain courses and you get certain grades, you can transfer to the University of Minnesota and not lose a credit. Two situations like Southwest in Marshall, I believe it is, where you can get a University of Minnesota degree and only take classes on the Southwest campus. To graduate programs with Moorhead and other places where you can get a graduate degree in nursing and so forth. I think we're in pretty good shape. Now, I'm not saying there's no tension at all. They have very distinguished four-year colleges in Mankato and other places in the system. So there's always a mission creep there, and I'm always thinking about, well, should we be doing more, as I think we probably should, to help reach the inner city youth and get them into the collegiate system and so forth. But by and large, I think we've worked very well together. We also, remember, have a variety of flavors. We have this great liberal arts college in Morris, and we have what amounts to a sort of polytechnic type of education in Crookston. But I do think, and I said this publicly, and I'm not going to tell you what my detailed views are, but I do think we're overbuilt in higher education in the state. I don't think there's much doubt about that. We've made good progress on mission differentiation and cooperation so that you can go to a Minsky campus and then sort of roll it over into the University of Minnesota.
Tom, your question, please.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I asked this question about a month ago, Gary, sort of rhetorically, because you had sort of an open forum for the callers to call in. Mr. Yudof, university has a huge infrastructure, specifically things like their own courier service, their own police department, graders, boom trucks. My question is, wouldn't some of these things be better let out for bids to the private sector and you people concentrate on what's important, teaching and research, I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, Tom, I think you raise a very good point, and I must say I'm very sympathetic, and I've tried to be, it's somewhat ad hoc, but we've tried to figure it out in area by area. So, for example, we have, with mixed results, I might add, contracted out food service, and now we're trying to improve that. And we have a lot of projects that we contract out, and we get some other services that we contract out. But, you know, I think your general point is good, that universities are not very good at running collateral businesses. And I guess, Tom, you know, I have to live in the context of a whole institution and our arrangements and what the culture can bear by way of change. But I do believe progressively in areas where it seems to work that outsourcing is a good idea. And we've tried it in some areas and it's failed, and we've gone back to doing it inside. And in other areas, it's been quite successful. But I think, Tom, you and I have very similar takes on this. And I'm trying to respond to that within what I think are quite a few constraints in terms of culture and outlook and attitude.
Guy, your question.
Hi.
Hi there.
When I initially registered at the U a few years ago, the system forced me to identify my race, and I was wondering if you could comment on that. It would seem to me that that would be illegal, that I have the right to not have to identify my race. And so I was wondering if you could tell me what you know about that and what you could do to change it. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, Guy, that's you know, that's an interesting question. And one thing, I don't know that we compel an answer to that question. I have to look into that. But my personal view is we should not. But I don't know all the legalities. This is a big debate that we have in this nation. But basically, we are required to report a lot of the data based on race. That is, in terms of diversity, in terms of affirmative action, in terms of minority businesses and their participation in contracts. And there's a large number of people who think you should never even ask the person to race, and there's a large number of people who say if you're going to judge fairness, access, diversity, and so forth, you have to have numbers. I mean, for example, our census does that. You've seen all the census numbers on the non-Hispanic whites and people who come from Asian origins and so forth. I understand your sensitivity, but frankly, most of the government agencies and a lot of our judicial policies are premised on having that sort of information.
Joseph, your question.
Yes, I'm a manager in the private sector, and I guess one of the questions I have is, in the private sector, when companies have revenue shortfalls, or even when they don't have revenue shortfalls, every year the bar is raised in terms of making sure you have efficiencies in place, that you're cutting expenses, that you're constantly looking at productivity and efficiency measures. Is the U doing anything like that?
Absolutely, and, Joseph. And I'm sorry, did I cut you off? You wanted to add something to it?
Yeah, the second thing I just wanted to touch on is I think you had raised somebody had raised the issue here of contracting out services. And I've worked in the food service industry, and I know a lot of times outside contractors are much more efficient and have much less cost or overhead in place than universities themselves when they run a food service operation. And, I think the governor has some real good points, and I really support the governor in the fact that he's trying to hold the U accountable and kind of hold your feet to the fire, okay, as opposed to allowing the growth in the budget.
Thanks,
well, Joseph, I respectfully disagree in part. The $56 million we'd have got wouldn't have held us accountable. We'd have had 14% increase in tuition, 7 or 8% retrenchment. We would have reduced the size of the university. We don't turn out widgets. We turn out people with educations. It's not as easy to measure. But we have to be accountable. But the answer is we did an extended accountability presentation. We know what we've cut, $33 million in central administrative costs. We moved around $80 million. We know that for every dollar you invest as a taxpayer, we bring virtually a dollar back in research. Every faculty member, on average, brings into the institution 1.5 times his or her salary. We know how much it cost us in terms of our facilities. We know what it costs to produce a student credit hour. We know the graduation rates. There is plenty of accountability. It's not as good as your business, and never will be, because human services are not the same thing as a bottom-line company that may have shareholders or partners and owners and so forth. But there's plenty of accountability. And frankly, I think the administration sort of backed into this. They had a vision of what sort of budget overall they wanted to have. And these accountability issues only rose once the decision was made not to spend much money. And I think that's not true. I think we are accountable. And I think if people will call the university, we'll be happy to supply you with the materials. We're really delighted. And compare that to any other government agency. And government agencies, I can say this as someone who believes deeply in capitalism, government agencies will never be as efficient as the private sector and his business.
I have to ask you before we wrap up here, a different subject. The Dalai Lama is coming to Minnesota here, and several public events at the university. Have you been under the gun from the Chinese government to back off from your participation in his public events?
Well, I'm a child who believes in reason. I did get one letter, I can't remember, from an official of the Chinese government, and I wrote back and referenced the First Amendment and freedom of religion and freedom of speech, and I have not heard back further, but I wouldn't call it pressure, but they candidly communicated their views, and I candidly explained why the Dalai Lama was quite welcome on our campus. And, Gary, that's sort of where things stand today.
Mm-hmm. Classes end tomorrow. In general, has it been a good year at the U?
I think it's been a very good year. I think the semester conversion has gone well. The students are taking more credit hours. Remember, I once said on the show that, I'm a big believer in capitalism and in pricing policies. So our half price tuition sale has gone real well. Students are taking, after they take 12 credits, they only pay half price, and our numbers look quite good in terms of the number of students that are taking it. We had a wonderful year for fundraising. We had tremendous support from some major corporations, 3M and ADC, and I'm sure I'll leave someone off the list, but in our programs. We recently recruited a director from AT&T, who's a mathematician, to head our digital technology center. So I'd say in all that, it's been a very good year. I think the problem is that the type of budget that was originally proposed would have been so catastrophic for the university that has taken enormous amounts of energy to get our message out. And so you see a lot of tired people walking around, but hopefully by the end of the month, they'll be at least reasonably happy people.
Do you think the debate has been good for Minnesotans in general, in terms of the role of the university in the state and so on and so forth? Or has it focused so tightly on budget numbers that bigger questions have been
I actually aside. Think it's been good for Minnesota, and I applaud the governor on that. I think people are entitled to ask the hard questions about how accountable we are. I think they're entitled to say, should we be a high tuition, high financial aid environment like the University of Michigan, or should we be something else? I think they're entitled to ask, should we be competitive in the Midwest or nationwide? Ultimately, we will have the type of university the people of Minnesota want. They pay a big chunk of the bills, and so I think it's been extremely healthy. I wish that the governor's number were higher, but I think the idea of having a public informed debate about the future and the vision for the University of Minnesota is extremely healthy.
We're out of time. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, sir.
Our guest this hour, University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff, joining us this first hour. By the way, if you missed part of the presentation or program today, we'll be rebroadcasting this program at 9 tonight. Right now, it's 5 minutes before 12 o'clock.
The Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 3rd of May, 2001. It's the birthday of Elizabeth Cohen, born in the Bronx, New York, 1919, who took the name Betty Comden
and along with her partner Adolph Green, wrote many, many Broadway hits. They wrote On the Town with Leonard Bernstein and Wonderful Town. They wrote Peter Pan with Julie Stein, Bells Are Ringing, and wrote the screenplay for Singin' in the Rain. It's the birthday of folk singer Pete Seeger, born in New York City, 1919. Learned to play the banjo, ukulele as a boy, and dropped out of Harvard University. Traveled around the country, hitchhiking, hopping freight trains, learning folk songs. It's the birthday of the playwright William Inge in Independence, Kansas, 1913. He was a drama critic for the St. Louis Star-Times when he saw Tennessee Williams' play The Glass Menagerie and decided to become a playwright. William Inge's second play, Come Back, Little Sheba, was a big hit in 1950. He also wrote Picnic, Bus Stop, and The Dark at the Top of the Stairs. It's the birthday of the poet and novelist May Sarton, born in Belgium, in the town of Wondelkem, in 1912. A very prolific author, produced nearly 50 volumes of fiction, poetry, and memoir. Her parents fled the German invasion during World War I, settled in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and at the age of 17, May Sarton moved to New York City. At the age of 19, she went over to Europe, and while there, she had an affair with the biologist Julian Huxley, and then had another affair with Huxley's wife, Juliet. Sarton's novel, Mrs. Stevens Hears the Mermaid Singing, in 1965, was referred to as her coming-out novel, but she disliked being described as a lesbian writer. She thought of herself as a poet. She said, when you're a poet first. It's the birthday of the journalist and reformer Jacob Riis, born in Riba, Denmark, 1849. Came to America as a young man looking for work as a carpenter, started working as a reporter. He was a reporter for the New York Tribune and exposed the terrible living conditions in the slums. Was one of the first photojournalists taking pictures of slum life, which he published in his book, How the Other Half Lives. And it's the birthday of Niccolo Machiavelli, born in Florence, Italy, 1469. He was driven out of the city by the Medicis when they came to power and exiled. Lived on a small farm and wrote his masterpiece, The Prince, in which he advocated the concentration of power in one ruler and the use of it in any way possible, no matter how treacherous, to establish and strengthen the state. Here's a poem by May Sarton on her birthday, a poem entitled A Light Left On. In the evening we came back into our yellow room, for a moment taken aback to find the light left on, falling on silent flowers, table, book, empty chair, while we had gone elsewhere, had been away for hours. When we came home together, we found the inside weather, all of our love unended, the quiet light demanded, and we gave in a look at yellow walls and open book, the deepest world we share and do not talk about, but have to have, was there, and by that light found out. Poem by May Sarton, A Light Left On, from her collected poems 1930 to 1993, published by W.W. Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, brought to you by the people at 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find 13 million gently read classics, bestsellers, rare masterpieces on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Production assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs.